Hey everybody. Yep, I'm Cindy from Oakland, and I identify myself as an all-around addict. I have identified myself as that way as long as when I started going to AA meetings instead of just NA meetings. Because I was like, fuck you, I'm not an addict alcoholic. I'm just an all-around addict. And that's not just with drugs and alcohol. I have an addictive nature. And I think it was really nurtured. So it was definitely both nurture and nature in my view. It runs in the family. But it also, because it runs in the direct family, like parents, they nurtured that in me as well. So my story, let's see, I don't want to take up all of the time. I want to give time for people to be able to speak. So I kind of want to go through it as quickly as I can. And I kind of have to go through it a little quickly. I just turned 62 yesterday. And yes, I know I look fabulous, but I also paid $20,000 for a facelift 4 years ago. So don't feel bad. You know, you do what you got to do when you don't have kids and you're vain. And I have 25 years of recovery. And that also was part of my gift to myself for, you know, just the clean time and for, you know, wanting to do something for myself. I got very, I really wanted to do something for myself. I've been all caught up in doing service as well. And like we were talking earlier with somebody here, it was that my service isn't necessarily always with 12 step, that my service is also outside of 12 step as well. But I'll get into the service work later, but that's also about getting out of yourself. So a long time ago, I was brought up in the 60s and 70s, and they were, you know, you think these are weird times. Those were fucking weird times, like really weird times. I look back on it and the kind of things for like the young people today, if they only know, I was given the diet pill at age 13 because I was about 30 pounds overweight. Couldn't sleep, so of course he gave me some pills to help me sleep. That was really my first speed run. Actually, before then, I had had my first drink at age 11. Let's start before then at age 11. And you know, it's interesting because alcohol never ended up being my primary drug ever. It was always the thing I picked up before I picked up the cigarettes, then picked up the other way around, cigarettes and then alcohol and then drugs. And before then I realized later, turns out sugar was my first drug of choice. And I didn't address that until last. So I was like peeling away the layers of the onion, which always is a weird analogy for me. And the onions stink. You know, when you peel away the layers, it's like you get down to the base of the onion and it stinks. It's like, that's why the layers are on there in the first place. But in any case, I kept peeling away and as I took the substances away, the drugs and the alcohol and the cigarettes, I realized that, and it took me years of recovery really to realize where it really started for me. And that was with really poor nutrition. I grew up in the 60s where, you know, in elementary school, I'd come home from school and we could eat anything we wanted. You know, it was kind of this catch 22 of being privileged. And I grew up in a kind of privileged, you know, white bread, suburban Boston environment, really sheltered. And I could just go in the fridge and take out the dryer's ice cream, which was new at the time. It's like, oh my gosh. And just take a spoon and start eating it. It's like, so no wonder I was 30 pounds overweight at age 13. And then my parents were what they described themselves as nighttime alcoholics. Okay. So that to them, they were very functioning, Well, they were functioning, sure, at work. They were not functioning well as parents, but they kind of didn't consider that. And their friends owned a liquor store, which is very handy. And they would buy, you know, Kahlua for the kids because they like the sweet stuff. And so we had a closet full of cases of beer and Kahlua and scotch and whiskey and all the stuff. And at age 11, I had really, I went to a wedding and had champagne, and that's all I remember. So the first time I drank, I blacked out. And interestingly enough, I don't think I really blacked out from alcohol ever again, but it certainly was kind of an indication there, you know. And I was with my cousin who we were very close, and he ended up in rehab as a teenager. So we start with food, and then we start with alcohol, and then I started smoking by age 11, 12, and my parents were 2-3 packs a day smokers, you know, Marlboros, crazy hardcore. And so my mother gave me permission to smoke in the house by age 13, which I knew was probably a mistake, but I wasn't going to say no. She didn't want me to burn the house down. That was her thinking. And she just didn't want to deal with, you know, me, you know, and my angst and whatever. And so I was up to 2 packs a day by the time I was 16. So I was a chimney. I was a freaking chimney. And then the speed run with the diet pills, that was really, I had already smoked pot by then and smoked hash, which I don't know if anybody smokes hash anymore, maybe in Europe, but, you know, so I was definitely in that scene of being, I was part of like the cool kids, but I was also studious. And so I went through that, and I had two older sisters who were complete wild child, completely wild. And I'm the one that stayed home and became kind of the caretaker. So there's that whole, if anybody's done Adult Children of Alcoholics, ACA, there's definitely roles that you learn that you take. And I definitely took kind of the lost child role, which is kind of the one left behind. And I kind of became very inward. I knew how to be my mother. I learned how to be my mother early on. I learned how to be a hostess. I know how to deal with people. I know how to be sociable. Everybody thinks I'm an extrovert. And the real truth of it is that I'm an introvert that knows how to act like an extrovert. I find it exhausting, but it's okay. You know, I mean, I just, in other words, it's not where I get my energy. I recharge alone. And true extroverts just recharge by being around people. So anyways, I got, you know, through the whole teenage years and whatnot, I didn't really identify as an addict yet, but I did identify my parents as alcoholics. And back, you know, this was the, you know, the early 70s or, you know, 74. So I remember I called Alateen, which was pretty new then, I think. And I don't remember getting very far with it, but I definitely knew I wanted help. And I sat down with my dad in his office of this car dealership that he owned. And I asked him to quit drinking, which was fucking bold. And he was very E.F. Hutton about it. If anybody remembers E.F. Hutton in the U.S., he's like, I'll think about it. You know, kind of gruff. Yeah. Well, he never did. But I was keenly aware of addiction and alcoholism. And then I got into the cocaine scene in the late 70s through friends of my sister's, and totally into that. But I wasn't like really out there like doing it every day. It was more of a fun partying thing, I guess. Because it's weird when I think back on my life, I don't remember really a lot of like real fun partying. There were certain times. I got in my car one day, and I drove across country to California, and I never went back. I was supposed to go back and start Berklee College of Music. I really wanted to be a rock star, which, you know, there was no like college for rock stars, but there was Berklee College of Music in Boston, which was more of a jazz kind of, not even my cup of tea thing, but I got in for the summer session and I called my mother and I said, can you get my tuition back? And I ended up in San Francisco in 1981. And I was on my own, away from, you know, the caretaking of my mom and dad, away from my sisters. I really was the one that got away. And I basically, you know, started, to me, I felt like it was, I look back and I'm a late bloomer in a sense, in that I stayed back to take care of my mom and dad kind of in their alcoholism, and I'd make them dinner at night and all this stuff. When I left and didn't come back, I started like having almost like my college years. I never went to college. But that's when I started having fun. And that's when the drugs were fun, when acid was kind of fun and weird. And there was a punk rock scene, which I was only on the edge of. I mean, Jesus, I went to a punk rock show in like 1982 in San Francisco, mind you. And I was tripping my brains out and I was in all white. Now, that's not something you do at a punk rock show. I go in there and it's like, you know, neon, what is it, the black lights everywhere. So I'm really standing out. And I just didn't feel like I belonged. But it's just kind of one of those things. I think back, I go, okay, I guess that was fun. You know, I got married to my love. I loved him. I did love him very much. However, he was a bisexual hairdresser and we were very much not a good match for each other. And it turns out a couple years later when we got divorced, I didn't know that he had been shooting speed the whole time. I was married to the guy and I didn't know he was shooting speed. That was my first instinct, or my first kind of run in with knowing about how people can be completely tuned out to what's going on. A year later, I was an IV drug addict because I met the wrong guy who said, here, let me just do it. Let me do it. And that's what happens to, you know, youth. And I was lonely and I thought it was love and it wasn't love. And I was already doing a lot of speed at the time. And I was in my 20s and I was lost, basically. And then I kind of, and I don't blame him at all. I mean, I actually, you know, I had totally forgive him for one thing. He's also since hung himself. So it's kind of, he was a tragic story. And I'm so grateful I didn't stay with him. I'm so grateful he left me, let's put it that way. And, but he did leave me with a pretty bad addiction. And I knew as soon as I put a needle in my arm, oh, this is bad. Yeah, there's one thing I'm so grateful. Some people come into the program and they go, God, I'm not really sure I'm an alcoholic, or I'm not really sure. You know, I just been smoking pot a lot. And, you know, I hear these people who are junkies and I don't compare. I'm like, honey, if you think you have a problem, you probably do. And that you hear that a lot. And it's true. If you put a needle in your arm, you have a problem. There ain't no thinking about it. There's nobody does that casually, especially goes, I had to go and learn how to do it myself because he was doing it. And once I learned how to do it myself, I was like downhill skiing right there, right down the hill. And I could not maintain jobs. I quit my job and I got temp work, because temp work you could say no to. My mother knew everything, but she was 3,000 miles away and tried to get me into rehab. And I said, no, long before Amy Winehouse said no. And I said, I can't, I have a life. I can't possibly go to rehab. You know, I have a cat. Who's going to take care of the cat? You know, all the things, all the things. But what happened was I did have, and I also was kind of wanted to be, I was really self-conscious too. And I also didn't know anything about the 12-step scene. And I was in a really bad way. I was one of the things that you don't hear a lot talked about here, and it happened a lot in this time, and it happened a lot in a relapse, I'll mention too, was a lot of, I did a lot of surgery on myself, basically. A lot of picking, a lot, I would steal like lancets and sharp things from dermatologists so that I could dig into my skin. I would basically lose my mind once I was on my drug of choice. And there were times, the one time I think it was the worst was I was in the bathroom for about 16 hours. And when I finally got myself out of there, I had edema, swelling of the legs so bad I could barely walk. And it was basically because my mind was I was conscious on one side, but on the other side, I was completely out of control. And I had lost any fun. There was no fun. Anyway, so I spent a lot of time at General Hospital at the time in the 80s in San Francisco. You could actually get healthcare for free. You could go to General Hospital and they would see you and they wouldn't charge you. It's amazing. They don't do that now. And I was I basically lived on antibiotics in between. And then there wasn't a lot of time in between. So I have a lot of scars. I have a lot of scarring that you can't see over the lovely Zoom filters, some white spots all over my back and my chest and my face. And I've, you know, also that's one of the reasons I've gotten a lot of kind of cosmetic work done is to try to do, it's part of reparations really to myself. I did a lot of damage. And what happens with drugs is that, especially if you're using needles, is that you're basically putting, you know, bacteria directly into your bloodstream, essentially. And so I was constantly fighting that battle and losing. And then it kind of sort of became a self-harm, a way just to do self-harm. Self-loathing was running rampant. I was all about self-loathing. What I didn't realize was that it was also based in clinical depression. In the 80s, it wasn't a big, huge thing yet. It was starting to get into Prozac Nation thing. I got into 12-step, my first 12-step program meeting was in spring of 1989. And I actually stayed clean for, well, after a quick slip where I didn't realize that alcohol was part of this thing. I was like, you know, I was outed in a bar where somebody pointed out to me, not in a bar, but in a meeting, somebody said, I saw you at the club the other night and you were drinking. I was like, and I burst into tears. I said, but I haven't had speed for 30 days. You don't understand. And they were all like, you know, the guy was completely off base, you know, absolutely not the thing to do, but he was also right. I had been drinking and I didn't understand that, you know, that alcohol was a drug, period. I quickly understood that when I drank, I called my dealer. So alcohol not being my primary drug didn't mean it wasn't a problem for me. I needed to be completely present and deal with whatever completely present meant. And I ended up staying clean and I did the 12 steps and I got a sponsor. Actually, I had two sponsors and I stayed clean for 5.5 years. And in the mid, and it wasn't until I got clean that I could do my music. It's interesting too. It's like, I, like all my 20s, I completely just blew away. And that was when I had the energy. So when I got into, into the program, I finally could get my shit together, and I ended up playing in bands, and we played around San Francisco, and I kind of lived my dream, but partially. Like, I never really did the whole touring thing, and honestly, in my 30s, I was just not into it as much. That, you know, to go, I would also have died, quite frankly. It was really good I didn't go on tour. It was actually in the clubs that I started slipping. And that was the, you know, around 94. And what I realized was, in retrospect, I started in sort of subtle ways. There was a particular year I was kind of alone. I had moved from San Francisco to Oakland, which is over a bridge, basically. It's 10 miles, not even, but it could have been a million miles. I stopped going to meetings, so I didn't know meeting people over on the Oakland side. I didn't know anything. I basically just stayed in my place, and I tried to give away my cats. I had two cats. They were like 12 and 13 years old. Like, what was that about? I look back on it with horror as an animal person now. I was like, but I also helps me to look upon people with forgiveness as well, because I deal with two different shelters, and I see people, you know, this one shelter just got a 15-year-old cat surrendered to them. The cat was gorgeous, 22-pound beauty. I'm like, who would do? Well, never mind. Like, who would do that? I would do that in the midst of, or the beginnings of, what was going to be one hell of a relapse. And so I started. That was one of my first signs, and I didn't see it as a sign. I don't even understand in my memory what made it okay. I started smoking again, and I had had a couple of years off of smoking, and then I started drinking again. And my band members weren't in the program, so they had no idea what that meant. No idea. Ironically, I started drinking again with my former sponsor. So that was weird. And by the time I went out and decided I was going to go use again, my drug of choice, both of the cats were back with me. I had to buy one of them back, because one of them I had given to, apparently, unbeknownst to me, a couple of crack addicts, and they couldn't take care of her and wouldn't give her back to me unless they gave them $75 or something. Okay, fine, I'll give you $75. Got both my cats back, and then went out on a run. And I said to myself, I believe it was even out loud, but it was certainly at least out loud in my head, I know that this is going to be hell, but at least it'll be a different kind of hell. I knew that I wasn't going to go out to have fun. It was almost like a punishment, I guess, or at least it's a hell I know. And the hell that I was in, I considered calling a psychiatrist. And we were still in that kind of era of, Prozac was all this bullshit, is overprescribed, all this stuff, and a little bit of that kind of nixing psychiatry, even though the program doesn't do that. It's people that do that, and peers that will do that. And I never did. I never made the phone call. Instead, I went and I copped, and I was out for about 7 months that time. And I ended up, I started off the first time I ended up putting a needle. I tried to shoot up through my feet, and I lost almost all the feeling in my foot. So I ended up at a neurologist, and I thought it was kind of hilarious, because he told me I'd be fine, but then he took me back in the back room, and I got a 30 minute lecture on Jesus. Oh, gee, what? I deserve this. I totally deserve this. And that was just the beginning. Toward the end, one of the last things, but not the very last thing, I actually used after this, I ended up in a skilled nursing facility for 9 days because I had dug a hole so deep in my face that they were afraid it was MRSA. And MRSA was kind of a new thing then, you know, the infection that they didn't know how to fight. And so, they sent a plastic surgeon to come and look at me, and turns out he was an AA. I deserve this too. And I ended up actually in my first rehab. And I say my first because I went through rehab. I liked rehab. I did well in rehab. I was a little bit of a, oh, I already know 12-step. You don't have to teach me anything. But I liked group therapy and it got me back into meetings. I didn't stay clean. Why? And I look back and it's because I didn't finish the program, really. I did the 30 days, but I didn't do the aftercare. They had a year of aftercare I could have gone to and I'd quit going. And I didn't use again terribly. Like it didn't end me up in the hospital again, but it was bad enough that I ended up in another rehab in Oakland. And this time I did the whole thing. I did the whole thing. I said, I just can't do this anymore. I was in my, you know, my mid 30s. I'm like, this has got to stop. And so I did it. I did my rehab. I got back in the program. I, you know, did the 12 steps again. And that was May 13th, 1996. And so since then, it actually is a lot shorter story. It's a lot of years, but it's a lot shorter story because there's not a lot of drama. Like one of the things I had to do in rehab, and I highly recommend this, if you're a drama queen, is drop the drama. I was also addicted to drama. You know, I was so afraid of being, I guess, bored, boring, what? I don't know. But I actually had a handle called Drama Queen because back in the early bulletin board, you know, the chat days of the internet, back when we were all using modems, my handle was Drama Queen. And she said, you got to stop using that. I'm like, really? Come on. She said, nope, you got to stop using that. And so I did. I stopped using it. Even though it was just kind of a reflection, it wasn't like really about. You know, I still also had a problem with kind of isolation. So I had to kind of make myself go to meetings. And I, at that point too, you couldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. You know, sexually, I was just like, you know, after that one guy and, you know, relationships, not my strong point, definitely not my strong point, but, I had a year clean and I met a guy in a meeting, who had about 6 months clean. And this is what's called a 13th step. Although it wasn't immediately a 13-step, I will say he actually had 9 months clean by the time we consummated our 13th step. And we broke the bed, mind you. And I tell you this because we're still together today. And so they can work. I'm not going to recommend them or not recommend them. It's basically I have found somebody. You know, the reason he got me was he asked if I would play Scrabble with him. I was like, okay, that I can do. Like, you want to know how to pick up a girl? If you want to pick up a crazy girl, ask her to play Scrabble with him. And we found that we were relatively an intellectual match, even though he had a, you know, master's in computer science from Berkeley. And but turns out over the years, I had learned computers and Unix, and I had kind of become a Unix chick and a computer chick and an IT chick, and we could talk the same language, and we could talk recovery, and we could smoke like fiends together, and we could quit cigarettes together, and then we did Weight Watchers together, and we did Jenny Craig together. We did all these weight loss programs because we were both speed freaks. We were both like sugar addicts. We're both like, and then we're different in other ways, but we were really compatible in the ways that really were important. And especially I found with him, his name is David, even though he doesn't love 12-step programs. And I, a part of that is because his dad is kind of a 12-step addict, long story, but it can really turn you off if you proselytize this shit. This is why it's attraction rather than promotion. I can't stress it enough. But we stayed together. I found a good guy. I found a good guy that wasn't going to cause me drama. He wasn't a bad boy. So he wasn't interesting in that way. He was nice. He was kind. He had his own shit, though, too. And I had mine. And in those years, you know, I've been going to meetings and doing 12-step. And he's decided he doesn't really want to, but he fully, you know, supports me and gives me the space to go and do my thing. And, you know, and I still feel like he's basically in recovery, and he feels like he's not, but that's his thing, not mine. But there hasn't been a lot to report. I've actually had two stable jobs. I probably had 30 in my 20s. When I got clean the second time around in 1996, I worked for a bank. I worked for them for 11 years. And now I work for a healthcare company, and I've been with them for 12 years. And I'm about to retire in about a year. I mean, stability. And was it boring? No. Life is as boring as you make it. And you do have to make, you know, put some effort in. But the only reason I was really able to is because I did address, like, before I even got clean. In fact, I ended up going to a shrink and exploring antidepressants, and doing therapy. And over the years, I've done every kind of antidepressant there is. I mean, we're the guinea pigs. We know it. There's no test. But when I knew that it was my issue when, after my first week of antidepressants, I realized, oh my God, nothing's changed. This is what normal people probably feel like, because I don't feel like bursting into tears every day. I don't feel like everything's my fault. I don't feel like a victim anymore. It also helped to work the steps where I started taking responsibility for my side of things, for my life, rather than, it's so easy to just blame everybody else and to blame bad parenting. And I, you know, I could do all the blaming I want, but the thing that really healed me the most is forgiveness and forgiving myself. I was at the top of the list there, forgiving myself, forgiving anybody who did me harm. And seeking forgiveness particularly through my changing my life, changing my actions, being of service within the program and outside of the program. A thing I didn't find until I was in my 50s. That was like how many years into recovery? Like nearly 20. I discovered doing service. Basically, I started working as a volunteer with dogs at a shelter, a city shelter, and found that nobody was there taking care of the dogs that came in matted and awful and like straight out of a Sarah McLachlan video. It's just like, oh my God, it was just driving me nuts. And I spent a bunch of money because I could afford it. And I went and learned, and I got certified how to do dog grooming. And now I do dog grooming, and I will only do it for free. And I do it for two shelters, and I do it for people who simply can't afford it. I do it for people who have difficult dogs that will bite a groomer. Try me. I will do it. I will wash a snake. I will groom anything. I washed a snake. I have shaved rabbits and cats. I mean, anything for the animal to feel better. And it's just, I am passionate about it. I thought I was just going to be passionate about going back into music and doing that. I'm like, nope, I found this, and it's just, I don't know that everybody finds their passion in life. I don't think everybody has to find a passion in life, but boy, I found my passion and I'm so grateful. And one of the things that makes me passionate about it is that it's not about me. I just love that it's not about me. I can't tell you what I get out of that. I really highly recommend doing any kind of service. And if you're having a problem, like wanting to be in a meeting, do service in a meeting. Whether if it's in Zoom, then we need hosts to do the meetings. We need Zoom hosts. We need people to help, you know, manage the waiting rooms or whatever. Once it's back in person, if it's not in person already for you, there's plenty of service to do. Give yourself a reason to be there and then start pushing yourself a little bit further. But first things first, it's all about really just being present. Meditation's not my strong point, but I do believe in kind of just trying to be present. I'm a speed freak. I'm kind of like, woo! But that's me not on drugs. So you can imagine me on drugs. I want to give some people some time to talk here. I'm not sure how I want to wrap this up other than I've never talked about myself so much as during the pandemic because I've never shared my story this many times, probably in the last 10 years, as I have over Zoom, just because it's just, we're everywhere now. And now my favorite meeting in my home group is actually a Zoom Thursday night Godless Heathen meeting that I adore. It's really my favorite meeting. Tusnua, thank you, too, as well as IPAN meetings. I love these UK meetings. And I love being in New York meetings. I went to one in Paris. It's just amazing. And so I really appreciate the global nature of it now. I appreciate that we're going to stay global and stay connected. And that's really the magic of it. And I appreciate you guys being here at whatever time zone it is, wherever you are. And thanks for listening to me drone on. And take care. I hope to hear from each and every one of you if we have time. Thanks.